And hello out there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org, and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. That was Dorothy Moore. That's last song, her album Misty Blue. And my guests today are Stephen Dunn and Judith Freeman. First up is Stephen Dunn. Stephen has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry for Different Hours in 2001, the Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, fellowships from the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations, 3 NEA Creative Writing Fellowships, a Distinguished Artist Fellowship from the New Jersey State Council on the Arts, etc., etc., etc. In recent years, he's been the featured poet in the American Poetry Review, the Georgia Review, and the Cortland Review. He's a distinguished professor of creative writing at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey, but spends most of his time these days in Frostburg, Maryland, with his wife, the writer Barbara Hurd. And he's here today primarily to talk about his new collection, Whereas. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
So glad to have you back. And I must say, you are so prolific, and this is a happy thing for me. I love seeing new collections by you come out. Could we begin, as we always do, with you talking a little bit about your most recent collection, Whereas?
I would prefer to answer questions about it. I don't know what to say about it.
Well,
except that, you know, it's just what I can do right now.
Yeah, well, you know, I have wondered, I mean, you know, ideas, we all have too many of them, but maybe let's start with when ideas gain traction and when you know they're a poem, when an idea becomes a poem, because I imagine so many ideas you get and they never become poems. So can you talk a little bit about the process of what happens, you know, internally, psychically, psychologically, creatively, what have you, before something becomes a poem?
I rarely begin with an idea. I usually find ideas in the course of writing. I usually start with a line or a situation, and it moves toward some idea, I hope. And then it's a matter of shaping and revising and maybe even 30 or 40 times, trying to get the world right. I have very few ideas. The ideas that I like, I've learned from what I've written, but rather than poem, ideas that precede poems.
Yeah. So in terms of revising, because I think probably to non-poets, writing poetry may seem like an easier form where, if you've never written poetry, never been a poet, you have no idea what it takes, right? You just said, you know, you might revise 40, 50 times. Can you take us a little bit into the revision process for poetry in terms of, do you typically get down a draft and go away from it and come back to it sometime later and then start tweaking, or how might that go?
Well, it goes various ways. A typical way is, since I like instant gratification, is to show it to my wife right away, or to put it in the mail to Larry Robb, my severest critic. And the presumption is that a good poem is a very difficult thing to write. So I even when you delude yourself to think you might have it on first draft, it truly is a delusion. And I get various feedbacks. And I think as far as my students go, when they make breakthroughs in their writing, they move from being utterers to was a made thing. And it creates its environment, makes its own. If you're working in free verse, for example, you're making all the rules for yourself. You need to hear what you put in the air of your poem, pursue it, change it. I guess the presumption is most of my poems I think of as corrections of the way of what passes for the truth.
Hmm. Do you write from a persona? Do you adopt a persona for your poems, for various poems? Does it depend on what the poem is?
Yeah, I have written persona, clearly persona poems, my first person poems are kind of quasi persona poems in that the speaker is partly me, whoever that is, partly an amalgam of experiences that I've seen or heard. I rarely write a poem when I'm really interested in myself. I'm not interested in self-exploration at all. I'm interested in making something out of whatever.
You spoke of students earlier and making poems. How do you teach poetry?
You keep on saying no. I think you can hasten the progress of a poem. You can't teach poetry from scratch, but you can make a poem that a student writes, say, or you write, and or a friend writes, and offer your best critical judgment of it, and maybe make suggestions of where the poem goes wrong. And good poets, people who end up being good poets, can take it from there. The revision becomes very hard for people who love their own lives and their own ideas too much.
Mm, you said that. Yeah, and that holds for all genres, right? I mean,
sure.
You know, if you are sort of fixed on what you are saying and how wonderful you think you're doing, then anything anybody says is not
right.
Going to go through.
You have to develop different allegiances than the one you began with.
Hmm.
Richard Hugo talks about that very well in Triggering Town. But it's crucial. If you don't hear the language that you've used in, say, the first four or five lines of your poem, you're going to make some mistakes. You have to. You start a poem, and let's say you have a notion. I usually don't, but you have a notion, and that drives the poem for a while. And then the other thing that's driving the poem is the language you found yourself using. And it's always a trade-off between those two drives as you're working through your poem. That you kind of know where you're going or where you want to go, but there's the language you've used, and if you haven't, you're not hearing that language, you're not composing by ear as much as by willfulness, you're in trouble.
Hmm. Well, let's, if we could, go to the book, and I'd love to have you read, and then I have some questions.
Mm-hmm.
Could you read the first one, Propositions, on page one?
Yeah.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine.
Okay, I'm coming to it. All right. This is an epigraph from the poet Randall Jarrell. What does a pig know about bacon? Propositions. Anyone who begins a sentence with, in all honesty, is about to tell a lie. Anyone who says, this is how I feel, had better love form more than disclosure. Same for anyone who thinks he thinks well because he had a thought. If you say you're ugly to an ugly person, no credit for honesty, which must always be a discovery, an act that qualifies as an achievement. If you persist, you're just a cruel bastard, a pig without a mirror, somebody who hasn't examined himself enough. A hesitation hints at an attempt to be honest, suggests a difficulty is present. A good sentence needs a clause or two, interruptions set off by commas, evidence of a slowing down, a rethinking. Before I asked my wife to marry me, I told her I'd never be fully honest. No one, she said, had ever said that to her. I was trying to be radically honest, I said, but in fact had another motive. A claim without a but in it is at best only half true. In all honesty, I was asking in advance to be forgiven.
I love that. I just love this poem. Let's talk about this for a minute, if we could. So this poem began with?
I guess it began with arguing with a friend about people who try to be honest. So I came up with the anyone who begins the sentence with, in all honesty, is about to tell a lie. That was the beginning. And everything else found its way after that.
Hmm.
Probably a good 7 or 8 revisions, I would think, at least.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. How about Come Visit on 28?
Mm-hmm.
Could you read that one?
Mm-hmm. The pages won't turn easy. Okay, come visit.
Yes.
On a day when all of the, let me start again. On a day when all the news seems good, must be evidence of what I don't yet know. Surely some nation or someone must be seeking vengeance at this very moment. Or one of death's many special agents has a plan with a reason behind it. God voices once again speaking demon language in his head. Maybe for a while all the news is local, and therefore a sweetness seems sustainable. But even then it might mean that sociopath hasn't yet emerged from his basement. It's still the nice, quiet man his neighbors, when interviewed, will attest to. Kept himself to himself, they'll say. I'm not trying to inform you, my friend, about what you already know. Come visit. I need to talk to a betting man, someone who still believes the future has a chance.
Mm. Now, this one to me, probably, you know, I'd love to hear where this came from for you, because for me, this was a political poem.
Yeah, sure.
So talk about it. How did this one come about?
I have no idea. Truly. I mean, these are things that, you know, the world impinges on us all the time, and the imagination responds to it. You know, the things that are alluded to, the maniacs with a good reason, the people who hear voices in their head, who do terrible things, that's become part of the real for us now. And I suppose the choices I made in the poem reflect that.
Hmm. So, speaking of politics, how do you think the current political climate will influence writing or art, or how does it influence you? And does it? Or
it
how does it?
It does. It does. I've mostly dealt with it in prose so far, actually. I have a book of essays coming out in a year, and an essay on Trump and the whole shebang. But I could deal with it in poems too, and probably will. I always remember the great all the stuff we wrote during the Vietnam War, which seems so urgent and important, which it was. But probably very rarely a good poem came out of it. You need some distance from the situation to be a good maker. But there's no doubt that this present situation is probably, now that you mention it, both something that will produce a lot of counter art, counter thinking, which is always useful for a poem. But poems have to make discoveries, and it's very hard when you're writing political poems to get beyond your original ideas. You know, political poems fail because there are very few discoveries in them.
Mm.
But that's no reason why we shouldn't write them. I think there's a time when you can make discoveries, when you say things you didn't know you know.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know you knew. If you're just going to say, "I hate Trump," that might be good for the soul, but not very good for the poem.
So are you saying then that the problem with political poetry is the poet is already going into the poem knowing what he or she wants to say?
Yes, yeah. And it will just execute it.
Yeah.
Just carry it out.
Right.
And my poems find their discoveries when I start to disagree with myself.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's good. You mentioned your collection of essays. What changes for you in writing prose? How do you approach prose as opposed to poetry?
Well, in many ways, it's the same. I want to say more than I think I know in the course of an essay. But prose allows you to overtly handle ideas better, I think. And I have one right here, in fact, that I just finished. It's going to be in the book, which is called God, Democracy, Trump, and the American People. Time for H.L. Mencken again.
That's great.
We need Mencken's, even though he was a problem in many ways too, but he said in 1930, for example. Let me just find this part here. The great majority of men and women probably do not know precisely what they believe, but the general cast of their thought is still towards something passing under the name of faith.
Hmm.
Men, otherwise highly enlightened, cling maudlinly to ideas that go back to the infancy of the human race. Worse, they assume that what they thereby permit themselves to believe irrationally, and against all known facts, the kind of knowledge. I have a lot of other good quotes from him.
Mm-hmm.
This piece.
Well, I'm looking forward to that book, and
you
know, it reminds me of a book of essays that came out on your work. I think it was by Laura McCullough,
right.
Syracuse
yeah.
University Press, last year, perhaps?
2 years ago.
So how did it feel, how does it feel to be written about and have your work written about?
You like it, of course, that somebody's paying attention to you. However, it was the first time, I think, where many of the essays explained my working habits to me, which I didn't find useful at all, because I would just try to live up to that, to what they said. So I tried very hard not to live up to that, to what they've said, to go other directions. But, you know, we all want praise and attention. And I did get a bunch of that from that book.
Hmm. Maybe we could go to the last poem in the book, A Short History of Long Ago.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, so much of your work has such bittersweet overtones or undertones or whatever, both. And this is one more of my favorites. Would you read it?
Mm-hmm. Interesting you mentioned, Tony, I was just talking to somebody about how what I admire in other people's poems and try for mine is a blending of tones, more than one tone.
Mm-hmm.
A Short History of Long Ago. Once it was possible to think I was happy if I had food, shelter, maybe a companion or two. I lived then without comparisons, mirrors, ambition. Television was the Lone Ranger, Dragnet, roller derby. I thought all bad guys would be killed or elbowed out of contention. Wars were over, and sex was what happened to others after a kiss, before a jump cut to morning. I lived in town, then a city, then on the edge, near the exit signs where the choices were. Experience, meaning what I could learn from failure, was just a decision away. I wanted to move into a future, acquiring friends, as I spoke of James Joyce, Harold and Maude, my blind, unsuccessful date with Liza Minnelli. I read the Bhagavad Gita for pleasure, or so I said, dared to speak of enlightenment to the enlightened. I joked I would have tried to become a Navy SEAL if I hadn't known I'd fail the final test of innocence and bravery. Couldn't any or all of it be seem true? I want to believe such a conjured life could make me happy, but my memory is too good. A bad memory is the key to happiness. I apologize for everything I haven't done.
I love it. Thank you. So in terms of, you know, going for more than one tone, this poem has that, but could you talk a little bit about that? Maybe embellish a bit?
Well, I'm rarely of one mind about what I write about, so that if I can mix sincerity with irony, humor with dead seriousness, that pleases me. And I think this poem is somewhat of an example of it. Not sure what else to say beyond that.
So in regards to this poem then, is this written from you, Stephen, or from a persona?
The same answer as the one before. It's an amalgam of people who constitute the I in this poem. I made up a lot of stuff. Some of it is based on experience or observed experience. Whole gamut of things.
What about the date with Liza Minnelli?
That almost happened. I wrote about it before in an essay. I could have gone out with her. Some guys knocked on my door when I was 18 or so, 19, and said their friend had gotten ill, and they were going into New York. I was living in Forest Hills in Queens, and didn't say Liza Minnelli because she wasn't known then, but Judy Garland's daughter. This guy was supposed to go out with her, and would I like to substitute for him? And I said, no, I have a date with another girl. And from then on, I started to make up the story of the date. It was an unsuccessful date that it would prove to be. Feel truer that way.
Well, I certainly appreciate you coming back on the show. It's always a great pleasure to have you and to have you know, your new books, and perhaps when your book on with the essays comes out, we can have you back on.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Okay. Bye, Barbara.
That was Stephen Dunn. His new collection of poetry is Whereas, published by Norton. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we should have Judith Freeman with us. So don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I spent the first half hour with poet Stephen Dunn. I'm back with Judith Freeman, and this show, along with hundreds of others, should be podcast within, hopefully the next week or so. You can visit penonfire.com. and it should be right there. You can also go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when it's podcast, you will receive notification in your box, your podcast little app. And if you like the show and would leave us a review on iTunes, that will help others to find it. And we want others to find it. In any case, I am back with Judith Freeman. She is a novelist, critic, and essayist. Her first book, a collection of short stories, Family Attractions, was praised in the New York Times for its originality. Her novels include The Chinchilla Farm, Set for Life, A Desert of Pure Feeling, and Red Water, named one of the 100 best books of 2002 by the LA Times. She's also the author of the nonfiction work The Long Embrace, Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved. She's won so many awards, the Guggenheim, the Western Heritage Award, so many that I'd rather bring her on than go over everything. So many wonderful things. And she has a website, judithfreeman.com, where you can read more about her. She's here primarily to talk about her new memoir published by Pantheon, The Latter Days. Let's bring her on. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on again. Let's begin by you telling our listeners a little bit about how The Latter Days came about.
Well, when Mitt Romney was running for president, it seems so very long ago, but in 2000 and, was it eight? No, it was 2012. I was asked by the Los Angeles Review of Books to write a piece because there was so much he wasn't saying about his Mormon background. And I ended up writing a long essay called The Mormon Chronicles. And after that was published, it was about the fact that Romney's great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, knew each other, were both arrested for polygamy, were both patriarchs of small Mormon communities in Arizona. But it was also a very personal essay in which I began to look at my own background, being raised as a Mormon in Ogden, Utah. I'd never thought that I really wanted to write a memoir, but after I wrote that piece, I realized that I'd found a certain tone and a certain way of speaking about the past, of looking at my past. And I felt like I was ready to write a memoir and went to my editor at Pantheon and proposed the idea. And interestingly, he said, "This is the book I've been waiting for you to write. Let's do it." So it came out last year, and that's the story.
So it's interesting that he said that he'd been waiting for you to do this. Had he ever brought it up?
I think he had in conversations, but I think he also understood that I think of myself primarily as a novelist, a fiction writer, and that I was a little nervous about pulling down that scrim of fiction. Mm-hmm. And where I've always used stories from my background and just, you know, standing out front and talking directly about my past. So he never pushed the idea. And I really came to it on my own, which is the best way, I think, for it to happen.
You know, there's so many interesting things going on in this book to talk about. But, you know, maybe, I think one fascinating thing to me is that you early on, you say you were prepped to speak before you were five.
Yes, that's true. And it's a very common thing in Mormon culture. Certainly when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s, and I'm sure it still is, but all children are encouraged to give what's called a little 2.5-minute talk before the entire congregation. When you're 5 years old. And what it does is it really begins to train you to be able to speak in front of people and to have confidence. And I think in part it helps later when all those young people are encouraged to become missionaries and to go out in the world and spread the gospel. But my mother when I was five, had taught me this story about Jesus driving the money changers from the temple, and we rehearsed it night after night. But when I got up in front of the whole congregation, I remembered something else I'd been taught. And I said, I'm a cute little girl with a cute little figure. Stay away, boys, till I get a little bigger. My mother was, of course, horrified, but everybody laughed, and that was sort of my first sermon from the pulpit, I guess.
Oh, my. Well, you also talk about, well, so many things, but that Mormon women have one of the highest rates of depression.
Yes, I've read that. I think there are certain ways to think and talk about that. I'm not sure that I'm the most knowledgeable person to do that because I've been away from the Mormon culture mm-hmm. for some years.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel that it's a very strongly patriarchal culture.
Yeah.
And that women are revered, but in a way in which they're kind of idolized as mothers and homekeepers, homemakers. And as we know, there's much to be said for raising children, for crafts, for canning, for making a wonderful home. But if you're really bright and you really want to do something with your life, that's half a life, not a whole life.
Hmm. You use the quote, I think at the beginning, I'm looking, or it's somewhere in here. A Milosh quote, when a writer is born into the family is finished.
Yes.
Did you know you were a writer back then when you were a kid, when you were growing up?
No. I was really hardly a reader. I grew up without many books in our house. We only had books that were really of a religious nature that didn't interest me at all. My parents weren't readers. I was never read to as a child. I never had a library card. I was a lousy student. I was a tomboy. I loved horses. I wanted to be outside. I think I was smart, and I think I was curious. And we had lively discussions around the dinner table, but it wasn't until I had left Utah that I really, at the age of 18. And by then I was already married for a year, and I had a child. But through certain circumstances, I ended up on a college campus, and I discovered reading. And I said, oh, my God, who knew? All these authors, Willa Cather, Henry James, Virginia Woolf, Thomas Hardy. I just was smitten. It's like, the Greek idea of suddenly being struck. I was just struck by the beauty of literature, and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to become a writer. And as completely improbable as that idea was, it was something I held to.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Judith Freeman. Her new memoir is The Latter Days. In this book, you talk about how your dad was very pleased with your first book of your collection of short stories, but he wasn't so pleased with The Chinchilla Farm.
No, he wasn't. The stories came out in 1988, and many of them were set in Utah, and some did draw on my family background. And I think for so many years I had said, I'm going to be a writer, I'm going to be a writer. And I might as well have said, I'm going to hunt white rhinos or something. It was so completely improbable. And then when I finally did publish a book, I think he did feel, well, she's done it. And even though he said, you haven't always presented me in the best light, I think they're wonderful stories. And by then he'd kind of become something of a reader himself. But when my novel, The Chinchilla Farm, came out a year later, it was too much for him, and he was very angry. He was very upset, and I got a very difficult, nasty phone call from him. And, that was the moment in which I really realized what the price that writers pay. for writing novels in which invariably they draw upon family and background. So that's where that Czesław Miłosz quote comes from. You know, when a writer is born in a family, into a family, that family is finished. But for me, what it really meant, I think, was my place within the family
mm-hmm.
was finished.
Mm-hmm.
The family went on, you know, kind of still as a strong unit, but I became more and more of an outsider.
Mm. So your dad doesn't come off very well in this book. I mean, I think
yes.
these days
yeah.
he would be probably called abusive.
Yes, and I never thought of him that way. And I wondered how my brothers and sisters would react to the book, whether they ever really thought about it in that way. And I don't think it was until I wrote the book that I really admitted that he could be very cruel. And it wasn't as though he was beating us and he was a horrible man. He was actually really quite a good man. I was born to good people, good parents. But he was born into a family of 21 children
mm-hmm.
in Snowflake, Arizona, the grandson of a polygamist. I was born into a family of 8 children. His father had been very harsh on him. He was harsh on us in many ways. And now I have to look at myself and say, how much of that remains in me? But it was very difficult, actually, for the first time, I think, looking at my father and not being afraid to say, you know, that was really cruel when he used to pick us up by the hair on the back of our neck when he got angry, lift us off the floor. Somehow at the time I thought, you know, it was normal that all children had fathers who got angry and did that. And then later I understood, no, that was mean. That was really, and it hurt like hell, you know. So it was a real cathartic experience for me to write a memoir, and I suppose that's why I put it off for so long, is that it had fearful components.
Did you know where you were going with the book? Did you do any sort of outlining, or did you write in scenes and put the scenes together later, or did you pretty much write it chronologically as it now is?
I pretty much wrote it chronologically, and I never make an outline. Obviously, most novelists never do. We work from intuition. We get started, and then everything is somehow revealed, and I counted on it happening the same way with a memoir, and it did. The only difference was that somehow I hadn't understood, I guess, the difference between a memoir and an autobiography. And I just sat down and wrote straight through, almost up to the present, even though I knew the book that my editor had asked for was really my childhood and how I became a writer, up until a certain point, let's say, my early 20s. And when I never looked back as I was writing. I barely read what I had written, except to start every day. And when I finished, it was something like 575 pages, and I thought, oh, my God, that's way too long. And I turned the manuscript in, and my editor said, I love the beginning, I love the ending, and there's so much there, but I think it ends here at page 320 when you're 21 years old. And I knew he was right. And so everything was just brought together. It became a shorter, tighter book. And I think it focused on the right part of my life.
Hmm. At the end of the latter days, you visit with your first husband, the one you married, I guess, when you were 17, your sister's ex-boyfriend.
Yes.
Because you have questions, and you learn that your father wanted to marry you off at 17.
I learn that when I announced that I was engaged to my sister's ex-boyfriend, who was 6 years older, and I went home to tell my parents. They weren't particularly thrilled because they didn't like this boyfriend calling again, another one of their daughters. And But what I had forgotten was something very essential. I really have often wondered throughout my life, why did I get married at 17? I mean, he was a very nice man, and I thought I was in love. And I figured it was my ticket out. I knew I wasn't going to go to college. My parents weren't, you know, sending any of their children to college. It wasn't a value in our home. And I think I thought that would be my ticket out into the world. We were going to join the Peace Corps when I turned 19. But I find out something very essential in that conversation with my ex-husband 50 years later, something I'd forgotten, which was that we wanted to wait. Our plan was to wait until I was 19 to get married. We were just getting engaged. And my father wouldn't allow us to do that. He insisted that we had to get married right away, the day after I graduated from high school. So in a sense, yes, he did force me to get married, although I made the choice, the initial choice, to get engaged. But how it was that I had forgotten that piece of information was astonishing to me. And I think throughout the writing of the memoir, one of the things I'm constantly questioning and looking at is what a fiction memory is, and what we choose to remember and what we choose to forget in order to create these stories that benefit ourselves or that protect us from information we don't really want.
Well, did you check out anything else with, say, your siblings or anyone else in terms of what went into the book, or did you rely on memory?
I relied on memory. It was my book and my story, right or wrong, and I was going to tell it. And I do think, you know, Mary McCarthy, for instance, in Memories of a Catholic Girlhood, she writes a chapter and then she goes to her brother or she goes to someone else and says, is that right? Am I remembering that correctly? And very often they say, no, 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 you have it all wrong. Mm-hmm. This happened. And often her memory was at fault. She wasn't remembering things right, and other times it was simply their version of events. But for me, I am and have become much more of an outsider in my family. And I felt like my brothers and my sister are slightly nervous anyway about having a writer in the family. What is she going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd made no secret of the fact I was writing a memoir, but I didn't ask for their collusion.
Mm-hmm. I think I told you via email that I, after I finished the memoir, I pulled The Chinchilla Farm down off the shelf. I have a copy. I love that novel, and I started reading it again, and I really noticed that the writing was really different. And I wondered about that in terms of, I don't know, style, voice, and whether, you know, for fiction and memoir, if you lock into a certain voice and that becomes the voice of that novel because of the narrator, for whatever reason, I don't know. Will you talk a little bit about that? I mean, does your voice or style change with each project?
Well, first of all, thank you for pulling that novel back down off the shelf and for liking it so much. It's a novel that's very dear to me. And I do think that the hardest thing to find, which I don't actually search for, with that much difficulty, it seems to come with every book, the right voice for the right story. And I remember my editor saying to me once that the hardest thing to find in a writer, you know, when he's reading a book and considering acquiring it, the hardest thing to find is voice. And I think it's like a gift, and I'm fascinated by what you say because I'm not sure I could point to what the difference is between the voice in The Chinchilla Farm, which is a first-person narrator, Verna, and the voice in The Latter Days. You can sense it, but I'm not sure that I could describe it. But I feel like when I found that voice for The Latter Days, it was almost as though I had to return at my age now to a much more innocent and slightly more naive and fresh voice. I did not want to write a book about a woman who's in her 60s looking back at her life with a kind of judgmental or jaded eye. I felt like I wanted to reinsert myself in that time, in that world, and see if I could draw forth more of what I actually felt during those early years. I don't know whether that really answers the question, but I do think each book is about finding that voice, regardless of fiction, nonfiction, first person, third person, whatever it is.
Yeah, it does answer the question, because I too felt that the voice of the memoir was very innocent. And in The Chinchilla Farm, and I haven't checked out the other novels yet, or your nonfiction about Raymond Chandler. I think you were on the show for that, and that book has since disappeared somewhere in the stacks. But it does fit the memoir. And The Chinchilla Farm, the voice in The Chinchilla Farm, Verna, she's very kind of, you know, I don't know. I don't want to say snarky, because that's not it, but very, you know, brassy and just out there. And and I love that character. And and you know, likewise, this memoir is so lovely, and the voice is very tender and just very noticeable to me, very different.
That's interesting. I also feel that when we look back at our former selves, there's a Joan Didion quote in the book that I'm not going to be able to do justice to, but that it's a good idea, you know, in thinking about our earlier selves, to approach that self with some tenderness. We need that. We need to look back at our earlier lives and ourselves with a certain amount of kindness and tenderness. I was shocked when I looked back at the teenager I was, who was such a divided child, a wild child trying to break every rule on one hand, on the other hand, trying to please my religious teachers and parents and the authority that really still controlled my life.
There's so much more to talk about, and we're at the end of our time again. I didn't give you a chance to read, but I encourage all you listeners out there to check out this memoir, especially if you're working on your own memoir. And I wonder if, in closing, Judith, if you have any words of wisdom or any advice for the memoirists who are listening, who may be working through something.
I think, you know, I've been reading a lot of Elena Ferrante. Not only am I besotted with her books, which I started reading years ago, the Neapolitan Quartet, but her collection of interviews called Frantumalia. And in that book, she gives, she says something that for me was true, and that is, what's really interesting is to probe the wounds and to not just open them up, but put your finger in them and wiggle it a little bit. It sounds, you know, kind of gross, but the idea is that that's where the truth is, that's where the richness is, and that's where the stuff that connects us all, not just as human beings, but as writers that are really trying to say something profound and important about the human condition. And if we can't do that with our own lives, to really look at the hard stuff and to try and be, to dive deep into that, and to be as truthful as we can, I think that opens up the ability to really write a memoir that has power.
Mm. That's great. I have to remember that. I just wrote it down. Probe the wounds. That's a good one. That's so true. Oh, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I've really enjoyed it and have really enjoyed this memoir. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Barbara. I'm so pleased to have been asked and to talk to you again. And thanks for being such a good close reader of my work.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks. That was Judith Freeman. Her book is The Latter Days, a memoir. And I do, again, encourage you to read it if you are a memoirist, and even if you're not, if you're a fan of her fiction. That's it. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, you writers out there, stay in the chair. It's the only way you're going to get words on paper.